the kingdom of God is supposed to hit all the different zones of life, as we call them, where we live, where we work, where we play. Those should all be inhabited by kingdom. And we talk about building cities within cities, that we view church as like a city. And when Jesus talked about his disciples working in the world, you know, he said, you guys will be like a city on a hill. These band of believers, those that had no power, but they lived as if they belonged to a different city. The ethos inside their little city was preferable, and people started to go, it's worth giving my life for.
Welcome to Park Street Dialogues. My name is Mark Booker, and I serve as the senior minister at Park Street Church in downtown Boston. This podcast is all about connecting followers of Jesus in Boston and beyond so that we might do more together than we can apart. In this episode, I have a conversation with Hugh Halter. Hugh is not from Boston, but he was in town to serve as the plenary speaker at the Embody Conference at Park Street Church, a conference for the church in the city that was helping us to think about how we embody the presence of Jesus in our city. And Hugh has thought a lot about that in his life, serving in ministry in Portland, Oregon, then in Denver, Colorado, and now in Alton, Illinois. And so I wanted to bring his story to this podcast because he has a lot to say that will challenge and encourage us as we seek to bear witness to Jesus and be on the mission of God in the city of Boston. After this conversation, I'll be back with a preview of the next episode. And then in the final segment, I want to share a brief thought about fear. Here is my conversation with Hugh Halter. Tell us who you're engaged with now. Just give me a sense of what you do as a coach and a thinker around the church more broadly.
Yeah, it's, you know, probably been 12 years of just lots of road time. It feels like for quite a season, it was almost every week somewhere in the world related to the missionary nature of God and the church. You know, we wrote one book that kind of ended up sort of hitting, and I think what a lot of church planters were thinking, then eventually a lot of pastors were leaning into our story. And
the name of that book?
It was The Tangible Kingdom. Mm-hmm. I think it was, I still can't remember, 2006 or 2008, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And that was kind of when we were having a contemporary missional conversation at a national level. A lot of, almost every denomination, because of the decline, was looking at, you know, what are the ways forward. And there was a pretty significant theological, missiological conversation that it seemed like God was having with everybody. And so there were either those that were on the missional track or not the missional track, but there was a dialogue between the two, like, do we really need to change the way that we do church to fit the culture, or is that capitulating to the culture? Should we just stay true to preaching the word and see what happens? So we got caught up in that a lot because that book seemed like half the room every time I would speak somewhere was there to fight with me, and half was there, as some would say, to save their lives and give them hope for, you know, another way forward. So it was very vibrant first 5 years. I actually really enjoyed it. The last 5 years, I always say the fight seems to be out of the dog. Nobody's coming to fight anymore, but there still is confusion as to how to move forward. But most leaders now know you just can't keep doing the same thing and expect different results. I know there's smarter people have made quotes about, you know, what that means when you just keep going. So, yeah, I think most leaders go, it's a different world now. However we got here, it's just doing church on Sunday is not going to win the day.
And if you could summarize your passion in this, or your message for the church around the world, can you summarize that in a pretty succinct way?
Oh, man. Well, originally, I would say it was about lost people coming to Jesus. Like, I feel like almost everything I did was from an evangelistic. I just always loved my lost friends. I just from middle school, I remember leading some of my friends to faith. I just loved that. But I'd say, you know, probably around the time of the Tangible Kingdom, I was personally going through a rework of why we lead people to Jesus. You know, back then there wasn't really a, you know, I guess it was for their eternal fate or something like that. And as I began to really study the teachings of Jesus on the kingdom of heaven being the gospel, and the fact that he framed so much of it for here, that's really when I began to awaken to the good news of the kingdom, like actually remaking the world, if you will. And prior to that, I don't think I was that interested in, you know, redemptive deeds in the world. It was almost just like, let's save the soul. But I really did start to believe, and it's a growing belief, that the witness of the church, the witness of the gospel, is what we do to make the original story available, and, you know, to where you can touch it and taste it and see it. That's why we titled the book The Tangible Kingdom. We just thought, you know, if we can make it tangible, then people are looking for it. And I still believe, Mark, that every single person is looking for the kingdom of heaven. They would love community. They'd love to not be lonely, and they'd love to not be poor, and they'd love to not be hungry, and they'd love for there to be more community and less hatred. I mean, there's all the things of the kingdom. I think they're looking for it.
Can you go back to a little bit of your story and how that plays in? So you were in Portland, and tell a little bit of your own story about how that began to shape your ministry.
Really, the story really did shape. You know, I'd say I always attribute one book besides the Bible to shaping some theology, which was The Divine Conspiracy by Dallas Willard. But it was, I guess, a crucible of real life that forced me to actually learn how to do ministry differently. And that was my son's son, Ryan, had really severe epilepsy disorder. And he had it since he was born. And kind of got worse and worse, to where he was having 20 to 30 grand mal seizures every day and every night without fail. And so that forced me out of seminary. And, you know, I say forced because I wasn't planning on any of this, but I had to leave that, and then I had to go to something I never wanted to do again, which was be a house painter like I was in college. So I had to go back to work and away from what I thought was what you do if you feel called to ministry. And and slowly God just taught me how he works. You know, I even sometimes I tell a story, this guy named Ralph, when my son Ryan, he had a had to go through a brain surgery when he was six. And it was going to be a little over $100,000. It's back in, you know, mid-80s, and I was making like $1,800 a month, you know, at the time. And so we actually were thinking about bankruptcy early on in our marriage, and a church that we were part of was putting on a fundraiser to try to raise money for his surgery. And, you know, it wasn't going to raise a lot, but it was just a really kind of cool thing they were doing. So tradesmen were putting up different trades that they would do for people. So I offered a paint job, and other people were giving, you know, old cars or whatever it was to try to raise money. And the pastor called me one day, and he said, hey, this guy named Ralph bid on your paint job. Bad news is that he only paid $50, you know. I said, you know, no big deal. You guys are raising a lot of money, so just give me his address, and I'll buzz over, and I'll do a couple of days' work for him. And so I got the address and started to drive across downtown Portland, and it was what was called the Northwest Hills of Portland. And it's where all the big Victorian mansions are at. And I just thought, well, surely there's got to be like a small little itsy-bitsy house somewhere up on the hill, because, of course, the guy would not bid $50 if he had a normal size house. Well, long story short, I drive by the address, and it's a 6,700-square-foot house. The back of the house was on these big steel beams that go down into this canyon that's full of blackberry briars. And so I parked my truck, and I really started to talk out loud to the Lord. I was like, look, this is not going to work. We're already going broke. And I knew it would take weeks, if not months, to do this guy's house. So I was basically telling the Lord, I'm just not going to do it. I'll go give the guy $100 and say sorry for the misunderstanding. And I really felt like the Lord said, paint the house. And so we argued for a while. I finally called my wife and I told her what was going on. And she doesn't say a word. I actually got a little kind of upset with her. I was like, well, what do you think? What should I do? And she just said, paint the house, Hugh. And first time ever, never done it since, but I remember I hung up my big fat brick Motorola cell phone, yeah, and I just sat in the truck just fuming. And after about a half hour, I just realized, okay, I guess I'm going to paint the house. So I went up and met him. Ralph opens the door, and he doesn't even, you know, I said, hey, I'm Hugh Halter. I'm from the church. I heard you bid on my paint job. Thank you so much for your donation. and he doesn't say thank you or, you know, whatever. He just says, hey, just so you know, I don't want you to spray paint my house. I want it hand painted two coats. So I just said, yes, sir. Walked out to my truck, started to unload. And for the next 7 weeks, I was working Ralph's job, and we went broke. We had, this was way back before Craigslist. We were eBaying couches and anything we could find to just try to pay our mortgage. And so, you know, I'm painting Ralph's house, and I get done with it. I said goodbye to Ralph. By that time, I had come to love him. I still didn't like him, but I loved him. His wife, Irma, she would make me these egg salad sandwiches every day, and which I hated. But I gave Irma a hug and Ralph a good handshake, and he tried to give me one of those awkward hugs. And as I'm driving down, you know, lamenting my life, I literally had told the Lord about 2 weeks in that I was not going to speak to him anymore. I basically said, clearly you don't want me to be a pastor. You have no interest in healing our son. And I kind of signed off, if you will. It was a real crisis of faith. So I'm driving down the hill, and I get a phone call, and this guy says, hey, my name is Scott, and I'm Ralph's son. Would you be willing to meet with me? I'd like to just share a few things with you. So I said, yeah, I just actually finished your dad's house. Meet me at this deli. So Scott and I met that day. And Scott was a big contractor in Portland. He built condominiums. And he said, I don't know if you ever noticed, but I would park my truck across the canyon just to watch you work with my dad. Because he goes, I know my dad would come out and work with you. And there's no way that was helpful. Was it? I was like, no, it actually really slowed me down. And he goes, but my dad would call every day and talk about you. And then my mom would call. And he goes, I just couldn't believe how much you were honoring my mom and daddy. And he goes, I know how much my dad paid for that. He bragged about it. And he says, I was sure that you were not going to finish the house. And I said, well, why do you say that? He's like, well, because you're a Christian. And I knew you were kind of like... And he said, weren't you thinking about being a pastor? I was like, well, I was. And he goes, well, I'm sure that you would not do it. No other Christians that I've worked with in the business world ever stand by their word. And so I actually said, Scott, look, I don't want you to think more highly of me than you should. I actually didn't want to do your dad's job. I only did it because my wife made me do it. But I said, just don't think too highly of me. And he said, well, just so you know, the fact that you did it and the fact that you honored my mother and father, he said, you've kind of brought me back. And I went, what do you mean I brought you back? And he said, I used to believe in God, but because of working with so many Christians, I kind of chucked my faith. And he said, I just really feel like I believe again. And he asked me, he said, would you help walk me back to the Lord? And I said, I can't. I said, I've chucked my, like I said, maybe we could team up. Maybe if you'll help me, maybe I can help you. Maybe let's do this together. And so Scott and I began to meet weekly and just read scripture. And he grew so fast, I had to grow back to God. And then Scott started to invite his contractors, his plumbers, his electricians, and a bunch of them began to come to faith. And it's actually how we started our first church plant.
Wow.
And then Scott one day, he said, hey, I want you to come to my office and buy a condominium. And I said, I can't. I'm still broke. And he said, just come down to the office. And so I kind of knew that Scott was going to do something. And and he did. He handed me some papers. He just said, sign right there. Congratulations. You just bought this new condo right here. And he goes, I think you should sell it because I know you need money for this brain surgery. And it was, you know, it wasn't quite the money we needed, but it was about $100,000. And we were able to get our way through the surgery. And then all of a sudden a church begins to form. And it was stories like that that literally re-taught me the way that God builds his church and about what it means to be called to ministry. You know, the whole time I'm in a crisis of faith. And now I look back and I go, if I had not painted the house, so like I wonder if Cheryl just prophetically blurted out, paint the house, because, you know, and we've joked about it. She didn't know that it was going to be that significant, but
yeah,
it was story after story of Ryan's disability. And so many people came to faith that we would baptize. And when we would ask them, what was it that drew you towards the Lord? And they'd always say, oh, it was kind of being in your house, watching you guys live with your son and inviting us into that. So, you know, we started to get this feeling like what we thought was slowing us down in ministry was actually designed for teaching us how God does what he does, you know? And so then that became the story of doing church out of our home and multiplying that into different homes. And so eventually people perceived it as a method of ministry. But we always tell people it was the only option we had. It's like God forced us to learn to live like a missionary, you know. And he taught me how different ways that God funds churches. You know, Scott became one of our elders, and you know, I really say I never went on paid staff per se, but Scott hired me as his primary painter for his condominiums. And he said, don't gouge me, but I want to pay you top dollar. And, you know, so that started to dig, you know, it's kind of how God provided for the Halters. But therefore our church took on kind of a flavor of it was an everyman's church. It was, nobody was really above anybody else. And yeah, people, you know, perceive me as sort of the senior leader, but they knew I had a job just like them. And that seemed to change the types of people that were coming into our church. There probably were folks that had given up on maybe traditional church structures. And so I mean, that's, I guess, a long story. The Ralph story to me is, it's hard for me to tell my story without that. But it was primarily that story and Ryan's daily story that reframed everything for us.
Yeah, that's a great story. Ryan just passed away. 8 months ago.
8 months ago.
At what age?
33. We joke about that a little bit. 33. We thought he was supposed to have died when he was 5. He's almost died hundreds of times where we were. We've signed his organs over about 10 times, thinking he was within a few hours. And then he would just sit up in the hospital bed and order fish sticks. And then we go another 5 years and another potential. Yeah, and then he finally just started to really fade. He fell down in our basement where he was living, and we didn't know, but he had hit his head. So he had a brain bleed that led to another brain surgery, and then they then the seizures started without any ability to control them. Usually they could shut him off with medication. Almost put him in a coma, but that wasn't even working. So we finally just said, just let us have him. We took him home for about 3 days and kind of watched him fade out. But it's a big story. Our whole community was a part of it. All of my two son-in-laws, all the girls, the grandkids, everybody took turns holding his hand. We had a 24/7 hand hold until he faded out. And end of the, we call him the apostolic leader of our family. He led us everywhere. And now I think we're stuck in Alton. I don't know if there's nowhere else to, no one else to lead us to the future. So we think we're going to just make Alton, Illinois the spot.
In looking back on his life, and we'll fill in the gaps to get to Alton as well, because I'd like to hear that story. How did that, I mean, obviously God used it to lead you, as you just said, but how did it change you? How did Ryan's life change you?
Well, again, it's kind of like the Ralph story. At the time, you're mostly just struggling with it because, you know, you're watching a son, you know, in severe turmoil physically. So I mostly went between anger with the Lord to, but then something amazing would happen from it. So we just started to kind of build a theology of suffering. And so mentally we were like, okay, we get it. God's using Ryan. And then the next day we would get mad at the Lord, like, use somebody else, you know, like give the kid a break. Now looking back, way beyond Ryan's story, just being in the disability community, sometimes I really do wonder, these are weird theological thoughts, but I wonder if when, you know, the Lord talks about angels that we're unaware of that literally enter into our human experience, I wonder if a lot of the disabled community and even people that are deeply on the margins of society literally are the angelic hosts that they kind of, they don't force us, but they angle us towards, you know, things that happen that would, like, I would never be the person I am without Ryan. I don't know if I would have liked myself, honestly, just left to my own devices. Even if I had been in ministry, I think I would have been a type A driving through people to get to some goal type of a leader. I don't know if I would have been a healthy leader. And Ryan's daily, you know, I mean, I never got much more than an hour or two of sleep a night. So I was, his life depleted me, and I had to slow down, and I had to change my expectations. My metrics changed a lot for our whole family. It developed, my two daughters are some of the most amazing women in how they deal with people. And, you know, but at the time, junior high and high school, Ryan's disability, pulling him out of a movie theater in the middle of the movie because he was having a seizure, they didn't like that either. But at the end of a series of always being interrupted by suffering, it creates a different type of a human being. And I have a feeling when we get to the heavenly realm, we will see Ryan and he will just be laughing as if he was planted by the Lord into our family, you know. And if we had never written books about it and never got to travel, I still would have thought, no, God gave us that gift of suffering. But now seeing how it changed the way that I view the church and the way I view missions, I'm even more thankful that, you know, I don't think I would change it looking back now. I think I'm very thankful that we had the story we had.
So how long did you do this church in Portland? And then I know you went on to Denver.
Yeah, we were 7 years in Portland and 14 years in Denver. And now we've been almost 6 years in Alton, which is just north of St. Louis.
Before we get to Alton, what were the big takeaways from the time in Denver? And maybe just explain a little bit of what the heart there was.
Yeah, the Denver story was unique. You know, we were taking some of the stories of Portland, just ministering to people from our home in the neighborhood. And Denver,
Can you say more about that in Portland, ministering from our home?
Yeah, and again, going back to Ryan, we really couldn't leave our house. So the conversation Cheryl and I were having was, well, if we can't leave our house, or at least together, I guess we're going to have to learn how to open up our front door and just invite the neighbors in and let's see what God does. That was one coffee conversation. Let's just see what God does. And so we literally did. We started to throw a lot of parties. It seemed like at a lot of the parties, we talked a lot with people. And then there would be more, Cheryl would talk more and start a tea time with three of the ladies in the neighborhood. And I'd grab the guys for a Thursday night, you know, whatever. And I don't, you know, looking back, I don't know why we started talking about God, but they would ask questions. And then when enough people were all asking questions, we would say, hey, why don't we just get together every other Thursday night and talk about life and God and pray for each other. That was how we always invited people. Mm. We never said, invite them to a Bible study or something. Mm-hmm. So when I would train people, I'd say, just tell them we talk about life and God and we pray for each other. I always found that people love to get prayed for. So we do that every other week and throw parties in between, lots of just social gatherings. Found that if you don't connect people socially, their spiritual movement is really stunted. But mm-hmm. if you connect them socially, then the spiritual movement just happens naturally. So we just started to do that. And within about a year, we were 50 people in our house on Thursday nights. You know, people standing in the doorway. And then we had to start going, I guess we need another house open. Who wants to do one? And so one would start 6 blocks away. And so then we just started to train people. And, you know, some people said, this is back when people were starting to use the term house church. Mm. We were not. We weren't actually trying to multiply any particular form. We just said, we can't leave our house. So, I mean, if you guys can find a church and then go for it. But yeah, it seemed like most of the people that were drawn to our movement enjoyed the neighborhood house thing. And so by the time we went to Denver, we had in mind that we would try to start a missionary movement. I was reading a lot of missionary books, mm-hmm. Read about the Moravians who would sell themselves into slavery for a certain group of people. And we'd read other kind of, you know, we actually studied the book of Acts, and we just thought, let's just try to start a missions. Like, and we actually started to play with the idea of, well, what if the entire intention of the church throughout the history of the church was that it was a missions movement? Because missionary just means sent one. That's all it means. And Jesus said, as the Father sent me, I now send you. Like, it mm-hmm. seemed like the sentness mm-hmm. was not for the weird people. It seemed like it was the normal thing. To be an unsent Christian would have been very weird back in the time of Acts, where now it's very weird when somebody is a sent one, right? We call them the missionaries, the ones we send overseas, but we never realize that that's at the center of the identity of what a disciple is. So we said, let's just start a missions movement with as little church structure as we can possibly manage, and let's not tie it to money. So let's go ahead and be a volunteer movement, and let's just experiment and see how far down the road we can get. And we just started to teach people how to engage their neighbor as a missionary, how to facilitate a spiritual dialogue around Scripture instead mm-hmm. of doing Bible studies. And we didn't have a Sunday gathering for about 4 years. So they had their entire weekends free. We said, so use it for mission. And we encouraged them. We said on Sundays, it's a Denver Bronco culture. So Sundays throw a big party. And then pick some night of the week, every other week, and read Scripture and pray. Maybe take communion and just see what God does. So that was kind of our grid. And over that 14 years, it turned into about 25 communities around Denver. Mm-hmm. And you know, they varied from 8 people to 45 people. Mm-hmm. And we didn't care. Just anybody that would say, look, we're gonna take spiritual responsibility for our own friends. And so that became the fodder for the book, The Tangible Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And we gave people like when you talk about the kingdom as being here and Jesus saying, yeah, make it available. We said, well, what is it? Like, is this some nebulous kingdom thing? Matthew 16, Jesus made an interesting comment. He said, I will build my church. The gates of hell will not prevail. And I will give you guys the keys to the kingdom of heaven. So we took that literally. We said, okay, Jesus he's not trying to hide us or hide this beautiful story of the kingdom from us. He's made it available. We can do this. It's practical. So we just turned it into 3 coachable rhythms of life that we said, just do these rhythms And we think if you integrate those, if they're not like to-do lists, if they're actually the way of life that you live, we think the kingdom of God, the good news, will become tangible. People will see it, smell it, feel it, and then they'll come ask you about it. And so that's what happened for a lot of our friends. And
what were those three practices?
Well, if you can think of, you know, for the listeners, if they're just trying to think of it, think of on a piece of paper, you draw three conjoining circles. The one at the top we call communion. And those are things that you help people, anything that you can do to help people commune with the Spirit of God. So traditionally in the book of Acts, we would watch the Christians. They would gather together, right? They would study the teachings of the apostles. So there's some learning, there's some teaching, there's they were praying together. Classic things that we would almost get in church on Sunday. They're vertical, so there's a vertical arrow on the communion circle. It's things we're just connecting people to God. And the other two circles, though, have kind of horizontal arrows, and those are not vertical. They're not about us and God. They're about us and the world. They're people on people things. So, and again, they're things that we saw at the center of the life of Jesus, at the center of the community of the book of Acts. And even if you read stories of early mission societies in America, you know, the Methodists, right? Wesley had the bands, people that would live out these methods, right? So they had these almost like rules of life, if you will. So we just said one of those horizontal circles will be inclusive community. We saw in the life of Jesus the first inclusive human the world had seen. Everybody else was divided or segregated based on religion or color of skin or economics or religion. Jesus seemed to bring people together. So we said, we don't know how it's going to work, but we're going to provide a place of belonging. The communion circle are things that you do just to be with God, right? The inclusive community circle are the things that you do to help anybody to be able to belong with you as a friend that you love. And so then the third circle would be what we call the mission circle, things that we do to bless people, just redemptive deeds, anything that would help them personally, save them maybe even. Anyway, those three circles, the way it played out on a very simplistic way would be, like I said, every other Thursday night we're having a little communion time. Almost every week would be a party, some type of social gathering, a dinner with three couples on Tuesday night, or a Denver Bronco football party. And then seemed like between those other two things, we would always stop and ask, have any needs come up that we can meet? And almost every week somebody would go, yeah, I got one this week. And then we kind of had an internal rule that the way we would coach people, try to meet the need within 72 hours if you can. And do it with as many people in the community as you might have. So, for instance, there was one night where we're having a communion time, Thursday night. And we saw in the news that a house one block over had almost burnt down. So we just kind of called an audible, and about 12 of us walked down, and we knocked on the door of this family. And we said, hey, we just heard about, you know, your house burning down. And we brought a bunch of groceries. So we didn't know what type of mess, but we've also got 2 hours of free time. Is there anything we could do to help you guys? And I remember I said, surely with the news story on the main channel, a ton of people have offered to help, but we wanted to offer a little bit more. And she was like, no, nobody's come yet to help. And so for a couple hours, we were helping them dig old stuff out of their burnt basement. And then we said, you know, we had chili on the crock pot before we came down. We're going to go back and eat. You're welcome to join us. And so that was a night where like all three circles were kind of integrated, right? And that family did quickly become a part of our movement. But it's, so it's not rocket science, but when you coach people to kingdom rhythms, it was just, it was every week somebody would go, ah, this works. Even a party works, you know, where they're going, you know, I've lived on that neighborhood for 8 years and they know we're Christians because they see us drive off to church, but it's when they start inviting them over for a football game, or they throw the, they take the barbecue from the backyard to the front yard. And all of a sudden you're talking. If you keep it in your backyard, It could be another 8 years before you even say hi. So it was silly little coaching things that we did. And it was fun to watch people see their friends move towards them spiritually and socially.
Is there a story or two from that time for you personally where you saw God really working to bring someone into life?
Man, there were so many. We had, when we were 50 people in the Denver house, 35 of them were adults that were brand new to faith.
Wow.
A lot of those were Starbucks employees. My wife, because again, we had weird jobs. My wife had to work at Starbucks. She became kind of the mom at the Starbucks. And all of a sudden there's all these Starbucks employees. And Cheryl and I played more like mom and dad for them. So they just started to bring their friends over. So that one was low hanging fruit. That seemed easy. There was one holdout couple. Yeah, it was interesting, Mark. We had 8 houses on our street. And at the end of about 5 years, 7 of the 8 homes were a part of our movement. And
wow.
A lot of baptisms and baptizing entire families, almost like you read about, you know. But there was this one house at the end of our cul-de-sac that was the holdout. And it was all because my disabled son came home with some pornography that he found from their house. And I had to take... And he didn't know it was bad. So I had to take a couple magazines back and tell the mother of this, my son's friend, that, hey, and I had to calm her down. She saw it. She started to hyperventilate. I said, hey, I'm not mad. It gave me a good chance to talk to my son about how to honor women, but I just wanted you to know that the boys found some of this up in the garage. And so for 2 years, the husband never made eye contact with me. And we would throw big parties for the neighborhood. They never came. And I knew it was all because of this. Somehow they felt shamed. Or until about two years later, we got a knock on the door about midnight. And I went down, and they were, both the mother and father were there, and they were in tears. And I thought it was some weird that they finally were going to say sorry about the pornography. And But I thought it was weird. It was midnight. And I said, hey, are you guys okay? And they were like, no, can we come in? And basically they had just found out that their son Tyler had bone cancer. And they said, we just didn't know who else we could go talk to. And to me, that was a meaningful story. They never came to faith, but their son Tyler did die. And I got to share with him, you know, on his last couple of days, and still we're friends still with that couple. They still check in with us on Facebook. And but you know, sometimes, you know, missionary life, it's not about sort of what happens at the end. It's that you're positioned as a missionary in your neighborhood. And if you've lived well, at the end of the day, when the crud hits the fan for people, I think we're supposed to be the ones they go to. And you know, who knows what will happen down the road, but we were very privileged that they woke us up. And
So that wrapped up after 14 years in Denver. And God led you to Greater St. Louis.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to say it was God, Mark. It was my wife. She claimed it was God. But yeah, we, Ryan, we found an assisted living center for him. And we took him out there, he and his girlfriend, Hallie, who they were part of a Young Life disabled group, and his Hallie's mother found it. And so we took the kids out together. They were probably early 20s. And it's the largest adult facility for disabled adults. And so we shipped him out there, and obviously we would go visit him 4 or 5 times a year. And as we would go into Alton, you fly into St. Louis Airport and then you drive through Ferguson. A lot of people maybe listening know what Ferguson is. And then another 7 miles, you cross the Mississippi into Alton, a little river town, about 30,000 people. It used to be 90,000, but we would come into it, and it looked very beautiful from a distance. But as you got in, you know, it would look like, you know, any really impoverished area. Started to sniff around, ask about the city, and average family income is about $20,000, $22,000, 40% African American, the rest white. even though it's on the north, you know, it was the north. It's where slaves actually would try to get across the Mississippi right there. Mm-hmm. Altonians would light little lanterns in rooms and houses to help the slaves know what was safe passage through. So Alton was really at the center of the Underground Railroad in the Midwest. And we love that history. And so eventually my wife just said one day, she said, why don't we just move here and, you know, sell the ranch and see if we can help this town out. And, you know, we had just shipped Ryan off. We were finally living the life that we always wanted to live, where we don't, you know, we were able to sleep at night. We were able to go out on dates. We started to do actually vacationing. We never were able to do a vacation, really.
Wow.
And my wife had a love of horses, so we leveraged everything we could, and we got this little beautiful 4-acre spread just south of downtown Denver. And that's when I resigned from the church. I literally resigned because I wanted to finally be married to my wife and not have the pressure of carrying a congregation. And so it was awesome, like for both of us. And then to have my wife say 2 years later she wanted to sell it and go help the struggling town. We got in a bit of a snit on the sidewalk. And I remember I told her, hey, calm down. Let's fly home. We'll pray about it. This is my way of, you know, kicking the can down the road. And when we got home day one, she's like, all right, let's talk about Alton. You know, why wouldn't we go? And I'm like, well, a lot of reasons. We're tired. We're exhausted. We're finally, God's giving us a break. All of our friends that know us tell us that we need to come off the front line and recover. And even spiritual formation guys were going, yeah, you guys need a break. And so I was bringing up all these reasons. And Cheryl just kept going, yeah, but are you praying about it? And I don't think I was. So this would technically be like a Rahab lie. But I said, yeah, I'm praying about it. And she's like, well, what's God saying to you? And I'm just making stuff up. I'm like, he's saying that we should not go. And I remember she said, it's so weird. It's like we have two Jesuses in our house. It's because your Jesus is telling us not to go. And my Jesus is clearly like, let's go do this. And honestly, I had led Cheryl our whole lives. My little ideas had led us. She had followed me. And all of a sudden, she's leading the missionary charge. And I'm the one lagging behind. And so we had a big family talk, both my daughters and their, one had a husband, one had a fiance. We were all talking, and I said, hey, Cheryl, tell them your dumb idea you're thinking about. And that's how I set it up. And she said, yeah, I think where Ryan's at, and she actually said, we're not going for Ryan. Ryan may not live another year, but I feel like God's maybe sending us there to see if we can do something to help this struggling town. And, you know, both my daughters said, it makes sense, let's go. And the, you know, the son-in-laws were like, yeah, let's do it. So I was the one lagging. And then, I don't know, 2 more weeks, Cheryl kept working on me. And she was like, what is your problem? Like, you normally like adventures. And I said, it's not that I don't want to go. The idea that God still has our face on his refrigerator, that like he actually... I would say anybody listening to this, this really is a great thought, but the fact that God has specific works that we're to do, I can't even deny that that's maybe the most important thing. I mean, I want to know I'm doing what God wants me to do. So I just said, I don't mind going. I'd go anywhere, whatever he wants. But I just don't want to leave. So if we could take everything we got here, this amazing community, the weather of Denver, no bugs, no humidity, sunshine all the time, beautiful snow, you know. If we could take all this and go to St. Louis, no problem. But we eventually, you know, I lost. We packed up the U-Haul and cruised into Alton with no idea what we were doing, just family of six. And then the most crazy, wild story starts to unfold. So
we got to hear some of it. So what happened next?
Well, not a whole lot happened for 6 months. You know, it's a town of 30,000. The only thing I could find that I wanted was a cup of coffee. Couldn't even find a coffee shop in town. you know, there was nothing there. And so I tried to buy a little gas station. I had really nothing to do. So I thought, well, I'll buy a little gas station and renovate it into a coffee shop just for myself. If, you know, maybe I'll meet a few townspeople. And the deal fell through. And I went home. I was a little dejected. And Cheryl and I were having coffee. And she goes, well, maybe we're moving too fast. We should just pray for a year. Let's not make any commitments. And then we'll see what God does. And about an hour after that coffee, after I said, you're right, let's just not, I won't buy anything. We'll just, we'll make our coffee at home, whatever. And an hour later, a guy calls that I barely knew. I had one lunch with him. And he said, hey, you got a moment? I want to drive you around the city, show you some buildings I own. And this guy, John, took me around, parked in front of an old federal post office that was right in the center of downtown Alton, right next to City Hall. Beautiful building, but it had been boarded up for 60 years. And he goes, what do you think about this? I'm like, oh, it's great. Love it. And he's like, well, I'm glad you like it. I think I am supposed to give it to you. I actually said no. I told him, I said, hey, Cheryl and I have decided we're not going to make any commitments here. And it's probably too big. It's probably more than I can really handle anyway. It looks like it would need a lot of work. And he took the key off of his key ring and he said, just keep the key for a couple months. If you really don't want it, give me the key back. But I really think you're supposed to do it. And then he said, I think you'll know what to do to help our town. So I took the key and we started to sniff around. And very quickly, one of my daughters said, she goes, no brainer, Dad. Let's make the living room for our town. Let's make a place where people connect and come together. So we did. We called it Post Commons, still called Post Commons. Everybody called the building the Post. So we said, we'll just make it a Commons. And it's now an all-day brunch cafe with really high-end coffee. And we've got a coffee roastery business. We've got a we're kind of the premier event space in our city. And so we do a lot of weddings every weekend. There's usually a wedding that we do. We've got a co-working space called Groundworks. And then we basically set up a nonprofit called Lantern Network, kind of based on that idea of people lighting lanterns and windows to help people. And we don't talk about that much, but essentially we buy a lot of it as a charitable organization, and our purpose statement is to incubate good works. So we're trying to be like a kingdom incubator, and we obviously help Christians learn how to go on and do unique missional ventures, businesses, whatever it is. We help people that are not believers, you know, start good works, and so it's become kind of like, I call it our apostolic hub. It's where we begin to disciple people into missionary life, and we don't have thousands of people. We have 40 missionaries right now after essentially 4 years. So seems like we grow about 10 missionaries a year, and we teach them how to engage the culture. And we all kind of, for all of us, we would call that our church. The entire network is our church. And it's been a wild story. When people ask us, like, what are we doing? Sometimes I say, we're like kind of like a Neo-Trappist order. And that we live kind of really rhythmic life together. Like, we see each other every day. We are building out businesses, and we're doing missional communities and neighborhoods. But we do that. We create the enterprise because we feel like it's part of the kingdom. That scripture that says where the righteous prosper, the city rejoices. That's sort of our big question mark mission statement. Is if the Christians in a given city would create enterprise, create jobs, create movement, give people hope for, I mean, Alton went from 90,000 to 30,000. All they've seen is negative population growth, losing more and more buildings, less and less businesses. So I'm seeing the real power that the kingdom of God is supposed to hit all the different zones of life, as we call them, where we live, where we work, where we play. Those should all be inhabited by kingdom. And So now, like when we train church planters, we talk about building cities within cities, that we view church as like a city.
Hmm.
And the cities we live in, Boston, it's a Babylonian city. It's a Roman city. It's it's held together by the principles of the world. When Jesus talked about his disciples working in the world, you know, he said, you guys will be like a city on a hill, called this Zion, the New Jerusalem. Like we got a city name, but we never view church like a city. We try to influence the city through politics or all sorts of ways, but when you've lived on the earth long enough, you realize how powerless we are to change Babylon, right? It's hard to change Rome, but Rome got completely usurped by these band of believers, those that had no power, but they lived as if they belonged to a different city.
Mm-hmm.
And they eventually took over Rome. You know, how'd they do that without political power, without religious power? They did it because the ethos inside their little city was preferable, and people started to go, it's worth giving my life for. So that's kind of how we view what we're doing with the Lantern Network. We're church planting, but we're trying to build a city inside our city.
Can you give us a story or two of people in Alton who, I mean, how do they find you and how do you connect and how do they become part of this
lots
thing?
That's a great question. Lots of different ways. I do, for me, I will say it's me. My other staff think I'm weird that I do this, but, you know, I try to keep office hours and hang out in the building just to be around. They don't need me to operate anything. Mm-hmm. I can be gone for a month and it runs itself. But when I'm there, I try to be there all the time. And I just sit at tables and talk to people. And if I've seen them come in a handful of times, I'll usually walk up if they look friendly, and I'll say, hey, it's good morning. It's time for your 2-minute talk. And if they look freaked out, sometimes they'll say, well, what is that? And I'll go, I can tell you're becoming a regular. And usually they go, yeah, we love it here. They usually will gush on our spot. And I'll say, yeah, I noticed that. It's great to have you come in over and over. And I said, people that become regulars oftentimes become a part of our family. And it helps me to remember your name if you just give me 2 minutes of your story. I actually tell them you can make it up too. Like, it doesn't have to be true. I'll still remember your name. And so they'll give me 2 minutes of their story. I don't prompt anything, but I usually sit down and I'll pour a little extra coffee for them or whatever it is. And I don't try to get to our story at all. I found there's a real power in just continuing to ask more inquisitive questions. Mm-hmm. I don't try to share the gospel or... I just try to start the conversation, and usually over time, they eventually come around to me and they'll go, hey, what about your 2-minute story? And sometimes those little 2-minute story talks turn into 20 minutes and 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one girl, it was a 6-hour, 2-minute story.
Wow.
And she had come into the post that day and, said that her plans were to take her life that day, but because of the time that we gave her, it wasn't just me, when I couldn't talk any longer, I had one of our female baristas come over and sit with her. I could tell she was struggling, and she's now a part of our community.
And you're trying to be an incubator for the generation of other good producing businesses.
Anything would be good. I tell the story of a woman that wanted to start a bakery. She was 6 years off meth. And met her down at a city market. She was selling her croissants and scones, and they were fantastic. And so we started talking, and I just said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she's like, I really want to have my own bakery. And I said, well, this town needs it. There's nobody baking at all. And I said, how can we help you? And I told her, I said, we're an incubator. We love to help incubate businesses. And so she needed a commercial kitchen to be legal. So we said, use our space. And, at first she was very skeptical. She found out I was a Christian by Googling me. And her and her husband were very open that they were atheists and wanted no part of our Jesus thing. And I just said, well, we don't really care. Like, we need good pastries and we'd love to help you. And So we started quite a unique relationship with them, where we took 20% of their profits at first, and then praying over them one day, we just felt like we could love them better. So we asked if we could only take 10%. And it just freaked them both out so much. They just started to really lean into us as a community. And now they call us their family. And yeah, she made the comment. She said, "You guys are making it really hard not to believe." So just, you know, little stories like that. You know, so yeah, we are an incubator. We prefer to incubate and help people that don't know the Lord, but we definitely take people that are also believers that have unique missionary ideas, be it a business, be it a, it could be a volunteer, social entrepreneurship, a nonprofit idea, anything that would help our town. We want to be a catalyst and a coach for that.
When you say, and it's interesting because Cheryl, your wife, said, "Let, maybe we could go help that town." And the guy who gave you the keys to the building said the same phrase, right?
Yeah.
Can you unpack that for us? When you say help this town, what does that mean?
Well, yeah, it's a weird thought, right? Like when I was a young church planter, I never thought about trying to change Portland. Like I only thought about planting my church. But most of the epistles are written to little towns, right? And we know historically that what Paul's writing to, or Peter, they're writing to really small groups of people in sometimes pretty big cities, you know, Rome. To me, the idea of changing a town is a better way to think, be it if you're a pastor or a planter, even if you're in a huge town like Boston, because it makes you think, I think, more biblically. It makes you realize that God has one church in Boston. He doesn't have 4,000.
Right.
We have four. When we think it's ours, we sometimes miss Jesus. When we go, look, these little 100, these are our sheep. We're trying to grow our sheepfold. And Jesus goes, "I have sheep that you guys have no idea about." Like for Jesus, when he looks at Boston, he sees his congregation emerging, and, you know, he sees everything. When you think townishly, you'll oftentimes think about what would be good news for the town. It's different than sometimes going, how do I keep my church people happy? You think, what would be good news? What would the gospel be to the city? It tends to move you towards practical deeds, you know? And what's that scripture where they see our good deeds, it glorifies God, you know? People are always afraid of, like, what they would call social gospel. It's never termed that way. It's just good deeds. It's like, why are we overthinking this? It's it gives witness to God's power when we lift somebody, or we hold their hand through poverty or through pain or through... I just don't know why it has to be one or the other. And sometimes when we think about our own church, we tend to try to pick, well, what's that one thing we like to do? But the good news of the kingdom of God is so expansive. It's at the level of a town. Like it... I tell the story of a young couple that's joined our team that started a very similar ecosystem. We call them Kingdom Ecosystems in Birmingham. And, you know, there, where we're 40 missionaries, there are 100 missionaries. They've got 21 businesses, and they call their network Common Thread, if anybody wants to find them. They also have Seeds Coffee and all sorts of other things that they do. But, you know, the mayor of Birmingham, literally the mayor of their whole town, when they found out that Taylor and Lindsay were moving to our town for a year, he said, "Is your whole network leaving?" And Taylor said, "No, just my wife and I. Network's still here." And he said, "Well, good, because if your network, if your people left, we'd have to raise taxes to handle all that you guys are doing for Birmingham."
That's amazing.
And that, to me, that's maybe a more clear picture, because when the gospel was moving through these communities in Ephesus and Philippi and Rome, it was literally changing. It says they were turning entire regions upside down. And that doesn't happen through one individual little localized congregation. That happens through a movement of people that they're all kind of pushing in the same direction. So, yeah, I suppose if the Lord had just said, "Hugh, go to Alton and plant a church," I would have, of course, said yes. But the idea of changing a town was a lot bigger I don't know, it was so big, even though it's a 30,000 person town. I think I needed that. I feel like at my age, I wanted to know we were making some difference. Mm. And I don't think we've done that great. You know, I don't think it's an amazing story. But enough people from the city have literally tapped me on the shoulder at grocery stores and have said, your family's amazing, or thank you for coming here. Mm. Or you guys actually are changed. I've had quite a few people say, you guys have changed our town.
Wow.
And it was just, you know, starting a little coffee shop just to give people hope that there's movement.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's kind of fun to now go around the world and dream at the level of the city or the town.
What would you say to somebody who's listening who thinks that sounds compelling in Boston? How do I get started living that kind of way, that kind of life, being on mission in that way?
Yeah, well, if you can, have a conversation with some people you love hanging out with. You know, it's one thing to start by yourself, but I always go, look, if you have some friends that you think are entrepreneurial, risk takers, maybe it's people you've been in a Bible study with for years, but you've never really done anything with them on mission. I would say, why not start the conversation as a team of people and go, hey, why don't we bump it up a notch and try to ask God for unique good works that maybe we could do together in our city. And if it ends up being a business idea, do a business idea. You don't have to do business, obviously. But don't think that if you get an idea that is essentially in the marketplace, that would be weird. Like that's, I think, going to be the center of the kingdom someday. And is emerging to be that way. But I always say, start with things, you know, maybe we say it this way, try to pick a fight that you can fight your whole life on. So, again, giving other pictures of this in Tampa, they have a network called the Underground, 230 some micro churches, they call them, with very specific mission statements. A lot of them even, they get branding. So their church staff view themselves as empowerers of the missionaries. So all they have a graphic design division, a legal division, a finance division, a visionizing division. So if you get an idea, but you go, I just don't know quite what to do to get there, they go, fine, that's what we're here for as a church staff. And they have a big co-working warehouse, and you can go there and get all the coaching you need, whatever it is. So I just say, you know, start where they start. They say, pick a fight that you would love to fight your whole life, and then find friends that want to pick the same fight. And if it's that you would love to try to tackle issues of poverty in that part of town, then yeah, just don't just chart right off, but take some time and ask God, what would you do? I always tell people, like, the Alton story to me is a really fun story to think that. And there's obviously people that go in to plant churches in Alton, and they're just planting a normal church. But it's kind of cool that we were walking and praying and asking, and then God asked us to start a coffee shop. You know, think about the Trinity all going, hey, here's what we should tell the Halters. And let's give them that building, and then let's give them $500,000 really quick so they'll get going. And then we'll get them going into the co-working space. Like, it's really fun to think about the creativity of God. God, of course, is a lot of things to us. Jesus is a lot of things. But at the very beginning, he's the creator of the universe who breathes life out of what? Ex nihilo, out of nothing. God creates out of formless and void. So to me, one of the really great things to ponder is that you don't have to be that creative. As long as you follow him, he's a creator. He's a creative one. If you get in his space where he really knows you will follow him and you'll do whatever you'll be surprised what he might give you a building. He might give you a dream. He might give you an idea. But then I think you should share that idea and ask a few people. It's hard to do anything by yourself. I try to find a community that goes. And you just go, let's be an R&D, a little research and development. Let's go on an 18-month journey and see if we can make a dent. And if he says, yeah, there's no coffee shop, so let's start. Like, I would not do the coffee shop thing in Denver or Portland because they have hundreds of them. But in our town, God gave us exactly what we need to do to really unlock a lot of things for our city. So if you can't change Boston. If I come to Boston, I'm gonna walk and pray a little bit longer, but I'm probably gonna find a unique localized neighborhood where I live my life in.
Mm.
I'm not gonna ask how to fix Boston. I'm gonna ask how to fix that one little enclave.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
What would be good news right here?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not your neighborhood, then maybe a network. It's it's a place. I tell the story. Our girls were in ice hockey, so 30 hours a week we were with the same parents with the same kids that were all over the Denver metro. So it'd be all of Boston.
Yeah.
Because all of our kids were on the top team for Boston, essentially. But when I realized we were 30 hours a week in this one mission context, it was like we were almost full-time missionaries just in that context. So we just started to go, all right, what can we do for these families? And quite a few of those became a part of our movement. So yeah, think about what's the fight you want to fight. Mm-hmm. What's the context that God's called you to?
Right.
And third, what would be the best news? And that the good news that you would love to be a part of delivering.
Mm.
And then I go, then you'll stick with it. Then it can be a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of Christians in this city who probably deeply resonate with, how can I help this town as a kingdom presence? And so I hope that all of them are encouraged. I know I am, Hugh, by your story and by your work. I've known it for years, but it's a joy to sit down with you. I've got two final questions for you.
Yes, sir.
The first one is just, where is God speaking to you in Scripture lately?
This isn't going to be encouraging.
That's okay. As long as it's honest.
It's been a year on Revelation 18 where God is saying through John, and I think he's saying to the church, come out of her.
Hmm.
He's speaking to believers that have tried to be believers inside the Babylonian system. He's actually saying, come out, like, no longer do your faith according to the world.
Hmm.
So I've been processing what it means to come out of, like, to literally be an alternative reality, or live into an alternative reality, not to worry. Because in in the way that Jesus reframes the kingdom, there isn't to be any more anxiousness, right? There's not to be any concern about money or keeping people happy or keeping people in pew seats, or there literally is not to be any fear. Like, so to come out of her almost seems like an impossibility, because I still fear and I still worry, and it's, but I am way closer to, like, I actually feel like it's doable. Like, I actually feel like I might get there someday where I can just walk in the world without any fear and help whoever God asked me to help and love whoever I want to love. Where I don't have to fight religious people. It's always interesting, that entire story of the kingdom, it's always fighting religion. So to come out of her, what's that mean? Come out, like, quit wasting your time with religion. And as Dallas Willard say, you can turn your whole life around and base it on this new opportunity. So it's an opportunity to not just do ministry or do methods, but to live a completely free life, free of the world. Let it flow through my fingertips. I don't need to store up anything here. I can live as though I come from a different town, different land.
My next question if you could say one thing to the church in the city of Boston, and you've said before there is only one church, and I would affirm that deeply, what would you say? And so you're going to say this as an outsider.
Yep. So I know that they won't, they're not going to listen no matter what I say. No, I would just maybe remind you of two things Jesus said. They'll know you by how you love one another, and they'll know about me through your good deeds, Apostle Paul has that framework towards the end of his ministry where he says, you guys don't need to fight for the unity of the Spirit now. And I think Paul knew if we look so disunified, they're not going to see. If we don't love each other. And right now, you can't even Facebook an opinion right now. Half your church will not love you for that day, you know. Mm. We've got to, as we say, we've got to pick a new fight. We got to quit fighting over stuff we don't know for sure. And start fighting for each other, which is, you know, even if I don't agree, I don't like your style, I don't even like the way you word it, that we recognize that if we're part of the family, we got to push the same direction.
Mm.
Yeah.
Great. How can people find you or follow more of what you do?
Well, I do about one blog a year, so it's not, but they can find my old stuff at hughhalter.com.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe keep an eye out for what we're going to call Brave Future. It'll be a new network to help people that are starting kingdom ecosystems and cities.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah.
Great. We'll link to some of those things in the episode.
And if they really need to talk or process, they can always email me at hughhalter@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for your time, Hugh.
Certainly.
Thank you to Hugh for having that conversation and sharing so many stories with us of how God has worked in his life and through his life. If you would like to follow up on the conversation, go to parkstreetdialogues.org, and the episode page has links to the different organizations that we discussed, as well as a link to some of Hugh's books. In the next episode, I have a conversation with Dave Hill. Dave is the pastor of Abundant Grace Church in Brighton. Dave has been in the city for many decades, raised his family here, and he has been a leader in gathering ministers together to pray. Here is a preview of our conversation.
I felt like, well, we have to try and uphold both of that and walk a narrow road, you know, as Christ said. So I'm always challenging people, is your first allegiance to your politics, to your race, nationality, language, whatever, or is it to Jesus Christ? And unless our first allegiance is to Jesus Christ, our unity is going to break down.
I look forward to bringing that full conversation to you in the next episode. In this final segment, I'd like to share a brief thought about fear. Hugh mentioned that we are called into this alternate reality in which God is on the throne, God is present, God protects us and provides for us, and we're free to put aside worry and anxiety and fear, not to have to think all the time about what we'll eat or drink or what we'll wear. God will take care of us. And I'm glad he brought that up, especially in thinking about going on mission in our city and crossing barriers and boundaries to engage with our neighbors, not again from a place of smugness or having it all together, but from a place of humility and service. I think that we're kept from doing that because of fear. And so just an encouragement that as the people of God, I know we all struggle with fear. Hugh said that he still struggles with fear and anxiety. It's still a part of everyone's life in this world, in this age. But it is an invitation from God to enter into the life of faith, confident that we're part of his kingdom, and to set aside fear. And that enables us then to take risks, to talk to that person on our street that we haven't talked to in a year or two, or to engage with the person we're sitting next to on the airplane or on the bus, or to have a conversation with somebody who's looking down, just to step out. I know there's often a real fear of doing that. So just an encouragement to let go of fear, trust in God, and let's see him work through the church in the city for his glory. Thank you for being a part of this episode. If you'd like to learn more, go to parkstreetdialogues.org.